Welcome to the Bone Coach Show, dedicated to helping you understand all things related to diet, lifestyle, bone health, and how you can live and thrive with low bone density and osteoporosis. I'm your host, Kevin Ellis, certified health coach, health and wellness speaker, and above all else, your bone coach. After being diagnosed with osteoporosis in my early 30s, I transformed my health through diet and lifestyle and now help my clients and community members do the same through my online coaching practice, BoneCoach.com. Look, there are no quick and easy cures for low bone density, but the choices we make every single day can have a powerful impact on our bones, our health, and our general well-being. I'll share the research, interview the experts, and help you figure out how to get the conditions right in your body so you can better your bones through diet and lifestyle. Short disclaimer, I'm not a medical doctor and this show should not be considered medical advice. Always consult with your healthcare team before making medical decisions and changes to your diet and lifestyle. With that being said, let's get on with the show.
When that caffeine is out of your system, you now have more tiredness, more sleepiness, lower levels of energy as your new baseline normal. And again, now you've become dependent on a substance just to get back to what used to be, what should be, your normal level of energy.
If you haven't done so already, especially if you're newly diagnosed with osteopenia or osteoporosis, or if your most recent bone density scan still showed more bone loss, go ahead and pause this episode and head over to BoneCoach.com to sign up for your free 7-day osteoporosis kickstart guide. That's going to give you everything you need step by step by step over the next 7 days to get on the path to improvement and stronger bones. You won't want to miss that. So pause this right now, head over to BoneCoach.com, and I'll be here as soon as you get back. Welcome to this episode of the Bone Coach Show. Joining us today to explore the key to unlocking your best energy yet is Ari Whitten. Ari Whitten is the founder of the Energy Blueprint System, a comprehensive lifestyle and supplement program which has helped more than 2 million people and counting experience optimal health, better performance, and more energy. He's also the best-selling author of The Ultimate Guide to Red Light Therapy and the host of the popular The Energy Blueprint podcast, which features the world's leading natural health experts. In 2020, Ari was voted number one health influencer by Mindshare, the largest natural and functional medicine community. For more than 25 years, Ari has been dedicated to the study of human health science. He holds a master's in human nutrition and functional medicine, a bachelor's in kinesiology, certifications as a corrective exercise specialist and performance enhancement specialist from the National Academy of Sports Medicine, and he has completed all the coursework for a clinical psychology PhD. You can find his podcasts, programs, and supplement formulas at theenergyblueprint.com. Ari, it's an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, my friend. It's a pleasure.
It's going to be a good one. So let's go ahead and get into this. And I always like to start with, how did people even get into their respective fields? And I'd love to hear from you how you made this journey into being, you know, the number one person to go to when you want to improve your energy.
Yeah, well, interestingly, energy was not my original passion. You know, in your case, you had an illness that kind of directed you towards something. In my case, it was actually similar, but it was a redirection. So I've been passionate about health science and obsessed with it since I was 12 years old. But back in those days, it was more of a focus on fitness, athletic training, performance optimization, bodybuilding. I was interested in muscle gain and fat loss and how to be a better athlete. I was a soccer player and martial artist growing up, and I was an aspiring bodybuilder. My older brother, who you also know, who's now a chiropractor, was always my best friend and training partner growing up. We did martial arts together. And he was a bodybuilder and personal trainer when I was a little kid, and he was being mentored by professional bodybuilders. So I was kind of, you know, I was looking up to big brother, and that was kind of my world growing up. And then, you know, I went on to do a degree in kinesiology, still very focused on fitness, bodybuilding, all that stuff, athletic performance. And then in my mid 20s, something shifted pretty dramatically for me, which was I went from an athlete, super fit, healthy guy to all of a sudden being incapacitated. And it was a result of Epstein-Barr virus. I got mononucleosis very severely. This is sometimes called in other countries the kissing disease or glandular fever. I wish I got it by kissing someone exotic, but I think I got it by sharing a water bottle with a bunch of dudes playing soccer. And unfortunately, and I got it quite severely. So after about 4 or 5 weeks of severe illness, which was pretty bad. I mean, I lost about 40 pounds during that time because I had two big golf balls of pus in the back of my throat, and it was so inflamed and swollen that I literally couldn't eat food for several weeks. So I was living off broth, and I lost a huge amount of weight, severely fatigued. And then the worst part was actually after that acute phase of the illness, I dealt with severe chronic fatigue for about a year after that. And it really rocked my world, going from, you know, as I said, an athletic, super fit guy, healthy guy with tons of energy to go all day, to train hard, to work hard, to study hard. And then at the end of all of that, go run around for 5 hours. You know, that was the norm for me. And all of a sudden I was laying in bed all day and I couldn't do my job. I had a hard manual labor job at the time working on a fish farm. And I couldn't study. I was also in school, and I had a girlfriend, and I couldn't put any energy into my girlfriend or my friendships. And basically I watched all my hopes and dreams in life just kind of fade away right before my eyes, because I didn't have the physical or mental energy to do any of it anymore. And that's what really put energy on the map for me. Is that's what made me, you know, that was the catalyst for me shifting my interest towards this field of energy. But it goes a bit beyond that, because this part could be very lengthy, but the very brief version is I also explored what conventional medicine had to offer for people with like me at the time, chronic fatigue, and what people in the alternative circles were offering. And the very short version of that is conventional doctors basically have nothing to offer. It's a little harsh, but it's really not an over exaggeration. They don't know what causes chronic fatigue. They don't have strategies to optimize energy. I mean, the tools in their tool belt are drugs and surgery. They don't have anything to offer. Unless they can diagnose you with something like diabetes, they'll give you metformin, or if they, you know, maybe you've got anemia, they'll give you iron or something like that. But outside of, or hypothyroidism, they'll prescribe you thyroid hormones. Outside of those kind of contexts, they basically have nothing to offer. And that's actually only 5% of people with chronic fatigue show up with a diagnosable condition like that. 95 out of 100 people don't. And then the alternative circles, at that time, everybody was obsessed with adrenal fatigue. And this is going to be a bit harsh, but I spent a huge chunk of my life looking into this. But basically the research shows that adrenal fatigue is nonsense. It's not a thing. And I was sitting there getting diagnosed with adrenal fatigue, despite having cortisol tests that were perfectly normal, you know, and they'd still try to tell me that I have adrenal fatigue and that was the cause of my symptoms. So it was my own personal struggle with fatigue combined with exploring so many conventional alternative practitioners that really didn't have anything to offer for me. And that was really the big catalyst that made me go, hey, it seems like this is affecting a whole lot of people. And it seems like nobody's really got this whole energy fatigue story figured out. Maybe I can devote my, you know, 15 years of study of obsessive study with health science. Maybe I can start to shift my focus to figuring this whole energy thing out. And that's what I've been doing for the last 10 years.
That's an amazing journey to get to this point. And I mean, along that journey, or as you started going down the path of, you know, figuring out what was at the root cause of chronic fatigue and how to boost energy levels, you obviously learned about some really important powerhouses inside our cells. Could you talk about those for a minute, what those are?
Yeah. Well, at the beginning of that journey, just to kind of carry on the story, my personal story, I started just, I didn't know really where to begin. So I started just exploring one thing after another and said, oh, you know, sleep, certainly when we sleep poorly, we know that we're fatigued the next day. What are the mechanisms behind that? How does sleep tie into that? And then I started exploring circadian rhythm before that was well known, you know, way back in the day. And, and started uncovering these mechanisms of how circadian rhythm and sleep and how they tie into energy and neurotransmitters and hormones and all these kinds of things like that. And then, you know, what about nutrition? Obviously, poor nutrition probably ties into this in some way. So what are the mechanisms of how different aspects of poor nutrition might impact our energy levels? And I ended up just going down one sort of topic after another. And at the end of like several years of doing that, I had this list of like 150 different mechanisms of how different aspects of our lifestyle and environment in one way or another impact on our energy levels. But I didn't really have any like coherent framework or way of synthesizing all of this into some sort of grand understanding of what is actually controlling human energy levels. It's sort of like a car. Like if you look at a car, you have all these different parts of a car. You've got, you know, the engine block and the pistons and the crankshaft and the spark plugs. And it would sort of be like someone saying, if we take out the spark plugs from the engine doesn't work. So the spark plugs control everything, right? That's the big thing that regulates it. And somebody else goes, no, well, if we remove the engine block, the car doesn't work. So the engine block is what controls it. And somebody else says, well, if we remove the pistons, it doesn't work. So, you know, that's what is controlling it, right? There's lots of different parts of a car and of an engine, and they're all necessary for that car to drive down the road. But what's really interesting is what is actually regulating whether or not that car is driving down the road. And in the case of a car, it's the person sitting inside the car, what he's doing with the key and what he's doing with the accelerator and brake pedal, right? That's what's actually regulating that system and deciding whether it's at a standstill or driving down the road. So what we're interested in when we're interested in energy of the human body is what's regulating the system. And it took me years to really arrive at an understanding of what's doing that, because there's lots of things, you know, AMPK and mTOR and this mechanism and that mechanism and cortisol and testosterone and thyroid hormone. And, you know, there's a million things, neurotransmitters that are impacting this system to one degree or another, but what's regulating it? And the big breakthrough in that was Robert Navio's work. He runs a lab for mitochondrial medicine at the University of California, San Diego. And he published a paper, I think one of the most important papers of the last 100 years. And it was called The Cell Danger Response. And that paper revolutionized our understanding of mitochondria, because mitochondria were always taught to us like in high school and college biology courses as these sort of mindless energy generators. It's like, it's just one of many different organelles in the cell. Like over here is the lysosome, and over here is the nucleus, and over here is the Golgi apparatus, and here's the endoplasmic reticulum, and here's a mitochondria, and da 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 da. And it's sort of like it gets lost in the mix of that. And everybody's just taught one thing basically, which is mitochondria are the powerhouse of the cell, right? That's what we're all taught to remember. But this paper from Robert Navio has completely revolutionized our understanding of mitochondria. And it's shown us that mitochondria are not just our cellular energy generators, the powerhouse of the cell. They are that, but they're much more than that. They are, in his words, the central hub of the wheel of metabolism. Metabolism is the entirety of all the biochemical interactions and biochemical reactions that take place in our body. That's metabolism. Mitochondria are the central hub of the wheel of that. And so they're not just one of many parts. They're not just the spark plug or the catalytic converter or the piston. They are the regulatory part aspect of that system. And the way they work is not just as mindless energy generators that take in carbs and fats and just pump out energy based, you know, sort of regardless of what's going on in the system. The way they work is actually as environmental sensors. They are basically like the canaries in the coal mine of our body. And their job is to constantly take samples of what's going on in the environment. And based on the feedback that they're getting, they are determining whether or not it is safe to produce energy. So if they're detecting lots of threats present, they turn down the dial on energy production and shift resources towards cellular defense. If they're sensing that the environment is safe, then they turn up the dial on energy production and they shift into energy mode. This is sort of like if, you know, if you were in a war zone and, like, let's say you're in the Ukraine right now and somebody threw poison gas in the street outside your house, it would be a mistake to just say, oh, you know, let's go about business as usual and open the windows and let the fresh air in and let's go for a walk outside, right? What you do is you close everything down and you seal yourself in and you kind of hide away instead of, you go into like hibernation mode, basically, instead of energetic mode where you're out and about, right? And that's what our cells do when they perceive themselves to be under attack. So mitochondria basically can be in energy mode or defense mode, depending on the signals they're getting from the environment. And everything, this is relevant to bone health, as well as every other aspect of health, every cell in the body, every tissue in the body works better, works optimally, and is in a healthy state when mitochondria, the energy generators of those cells, are in energy mode instead of defense mode.
And what does defense mode look like?
There's a lot of aspects to it. But the big picture of, like, to understand it more broadly is when cells are under attack, they're sealing themselves off and shutting down energy production. Okay. So they actually stiffen cell membranes so that communication between cells doesn't happen as well. There is also, in the way mitochondria work, instead of throwing off lots of ATP, what they start doing is throwing off lots of reactive oxygen species. And part of that is actually a defense mechanism. Reactive oxygen species are oxidants. So if people have heard of antioxidants and free radicals, people are taught to think like, oh, antioxidants are good, free radicals are bad. The story is actually quite a bit more complex than that. But too much free radicals or oxidants certainly is harmful and can cause damage at the cellular level. But that's part of what mitochondria are designed to do when they're under attack. And there's good reason, evolutionarily speaking, for that. For example, one of the ways, so maybe I'll explain this part first. Mitochondria can sense basically every type of stressor or danger signal you can think of, from poor nutrition to a physical injury to physical overtraining to psychological stress to sleep deprivation to intestinal permeability to toxicants, environmental toxicants, to any other type of stressor you can imagine, to pathogens like infections, viruses. And when, for example, you are infected with a virus and the virus starts making its way into your cells, it can actually hijack the energy being produced by mitochondria to use for its own replication. So part of the reason mitochondria shut down energy and then they stiffen the cell membranes is they're sealing themselves off and they're trying to seal, let's say, that toxic compound or that virus inside of the cells. And then they actually shift into a defense mode where they start attacking it, essentially. And they can attack it by producing large amounts of oxidants, free radicals. In this way, mitochondria are actually part of our immune system, and they are actually central to the innate immune system. So it's sort of part of the first line of defenses. And this is a big reason why, for example, young healthy people generally do a lot better with respiratory viruses than older people. It's because their innate immune system is very robust, whereas in old age, most people lose the health of their mitochondria and their innate immune system. So anyway, that the story is sort of endlessly complex there as far as what mitochondria do when they're in defense mode. There's many, many, many aspects of it, but that's a oversimplified view of, you know, one key aspect of what they're doing.
And are you determined to lose your mitochondria as you age?
Good question. So we have research showing that on average, people lose about 10% of their mitochondrial capacity with each decade of life. So usually from about the age of 20, it starts declining. That might not sound like that much, but I'll put it in another way. By the time people are 70, most people have lost 75% of their cellular energy production capacity, of their mitochondrial capacity. And this is the equivalent of going from a super powerful V8 engine to like a lawnmower engine in your cells, right? There's a big difference. And if you've got a lawnmower engine in your cells instead of a powerful 400 horsepower V8 engine, you are going to produce a lot less energy. You have the capacity to produce a lot less energy. And this also ties in very much with resilience. That's another, requires some more explanation to get into that. But just going with this energy angle, basically what's happening is we physically lose mitochondria as we age. And we lose, by the time we're 70, most people lose about 50% of their actual physical mitochondria, the number of mitochondria per cell. So on average, we have about 500 to 2,000 mitochondria per cell. This is the equivalent of going from 2,000 in your cells when you're young to 1,000 when you're older. And at the same time, there's another 50% loss in the energy production capacity of each individual mitochondria. So 50% loss of the number, and the ones that are present can only produce 50% of the energy. So if you do the math on that, basically you get a 75% loss of cellular energy producing capacity. So the good news is that it doesn't have to be this way. This is actually, it turns out, not a natural product of aging itself, but is actually the product of modern lifestyles, and specifically the lack of hormetic stress. So the right way to think about this is, and again, this very much ties into discussions of bone health, musculoskeletal health, but let's use bones as an example. So imagine that you fracture a bone and you get a cast on. And, you know, I've unfortunately broken all too many bones in my life. When you have, let's say, a broken leg, you get a cast on for 8 weeks, and then you go to the doctor, you've been on crutches for 8 weeks, you go to the doctor, they saw off your cast, you look down at your leg, and you notice two things, maybe three things. One, it's shockingly pale and disgusting, which is gross, but we all know why. And then two, it's extremely hairy. I don't have an explanation for that. I've never looked into why it gets so hairy. Irrelevant though. And the most important thing is it's half the size as the other one. So you literally, in the span of just 2 months, lost half the muscle on your leg as a result of immobilizing it, as a result of not using it. And what's going on here is that the body is ruthless in getting rid of energetically costly tissue that isn't necessary for survival. It doesn't care about your leg and maintaining muscle mass. It goes, as soon as you immobilize it, it goes, oh, I guess we don't need all that muscle there anymore. It's just a waste of energy. Let's get rid of it, right? Guess what's super energetically costly? Mitochondria. They're amazingly energetically costly. Just a quick aside to understand this. One animal that is extremely dense in mitochondria is a hummingbird. Okay, all different animal species have different densities of mitochondria in their cells. Hummingbirds, I think, have the most mitochondria per cell of any animal species. And that's why they can go and flap, I don't know, whatever it is, 60 times per second or something crazy like that. But hummingbirds actually, their whole existence revolves around constantly consuming nectar, sugar water, to sustain that many mitochondria. They have to do it basically constantly throughout the day. And in order, they have so many mitochondria, and it's such a survival, what's the right word? Vulnerability. Like, it makes them very prone to starving to death by having that many mitochondria per cell, that they actually have to enter almost into a state of hibernation just to survive the night just to survive a single nighttime period. That's how much energy they're burning. So you can, if you ever are lucky enough to find a hummingbird that's sleeping in this state at night, you can literally pick it up and hold it in your hand. It won't move. Like, it's in another state of consciousness where it's shut down everything just to survive the night. It has to shut down all the engines. Anyway, all of this is to say that the body gets rid of mitochondria unless they are needed for survival, unless you are creating the signals to your body that communicate to your body, I need those mitochondria to be big and strong and robust and healthy, and I need lots of them to survive the demands of my life. And if you don't have those signals on, then it's the same thing as a muscle immobilized in a cast. The body says, oh, guess we don't need those anymore. Let's get rid of them. They atrophy, they shrivel, they shrink, and they literally die off. But this is a product of hermetic stress. Okay, so meaning to the extent that you are challenging that system, challenging and stimulating your mitochondria, they will remain big and robust. It's also very true of our musculoskeletal, our bone health as well. And to the extent that you're not challenging the system, it will tend to atrophy and weaken.
Gosh, that's, if you're listening to this right now and any of this is resonating with you, or you're like, wow, that was really fascinating. I mean, Ari is sharing some amazing information right now. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that like button, punch that subscribe button, share this with somebody you know, because we're about to talk about some really interesting things as it relates to improving your mitochondria and your energy and things like that. So, and if you're on the podcast, do the same thing. So thanks so much for diving into that. And then, you know, I would love to talk about, let's talk about some of the specific things for how you can actually go about either slowing, stopping, halting that process, or getting to the point where we've actually got, you know, an improvement in the efficiency of our mitochondria too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So this is one area that I think there's a lot of misunderstanding out there. There's a lot of people talking about mitochondria now. You know, and 10 years ago when I started talking about mitochondria, there's very few people talking about it. It was more, everybody was obsessed with like cortisol and the adrenals and hormones, thyroid hormone. And now a lot of people are talking about mitochondria. But I find generally the discussion, and you know, if you work with a functional medicine practitioner, typically it boils down to like some description of mitochondrial dysfunction. Oh, your mitochondria are dysfunctioning. They're not optimal. How do we resolve that? Well, we supplement with CoQ10 and B vitamins and acetyl L-carnitine and alpha lipoic acid and D-ribose and things like that. We provide these nutrients and cofactors for mitochondrial energy production and antioxidants, and voila, now we fix mitochondrial dysfunction. Well, the piece that they're leaving out of that story is what I just described. The fact that most people's mitochondrial capacity, their cellular engine, has been reduced by 50 or 75% as they've gotten older because they're not doing the right things in their lifestyle. This cannot be fixed by just supplementing with mitochondrial supplements and antioxidants. You don't build your cellular engine that way. You can fix nutrient deficiencies, and you can provide cofactors that facilitate the mitochondria that you do have to produce energy better. But you'll have very little impact on actually rebuilding the cellular engine itself. So the goal is, number one, as you said, to stop the progressive atrophy of our mitochondrial network, of our cellular engines, and to rebuild it. And the good news is you can rebuild it. There is a process called mitochondrial biogenesis, which is the creation of new mitochondria from scratch. And the good news is also that the same things that stop the progression of it are also the things that stimulate it to be rebuilt. Now, how do you build bones to be stronger and more dense? You subject them to some stress, right? And the cool thing is we're built with this amazing body, with this incredible innate intelligence that is able to respond to those stressors, those signals that it's getting from your environment and how you're using your body, by adapting to that situation. You know, we're blessed to live inside of these incredible adaptive machines. and that are constantly trying to read what's going on in the environment and go, how can I better survive this situation? Right. So if we want to maintain our mitochondria and grow them, and by the way, and to, if we want to do that, then we need to create the signals for that to happen. And I should mention, this is not only a story of energy levels. There's a huge body of evidence now showing that low mitochondrial capacity and mitochondrial dysfunction are at the core of numerous different diseases. Most of the chronic diseases, chronic degenerative diseases that are the major killers in our society. There's huge links with heart disease, cancer, neurodegenerative disease, bone loss, osteoporosis, not just chronic fatigue. And I should also mention that it has to do with your resilience in life, your body's ability to handle stress, and whether it's damaged from it or not, or whether you can handle that stress and maintain health in homeostasis and high energy levels, or whether it degenerates you. And longevity, the rate of aging itself at a cellular level, largely relates to your mitochondrial capacity. So this isn't just purely a story of like, how much energy do you have? Are you up here? Or are you here? Or are you here? This is also central to every aspect of our health, our risk of disease, and how long we live. So hormetic stress is the big key to rebuilding our cellular engine. And hormetic stress is transient metabolic stress that stimulates our bodies, our adaptive machines, to adapt to that stress by growing stronger in some way. And hormetic stressors include everything from exercise, and exercise is multiple different types of hormetic stressors that each have their own unique fingerprint of adaptations that they're stimulating in the body. And things like thermal stress, heat and cold stress, saunas, ice bath, cold showers, going in the cold ocean, like I surfed this morning. And if I wasn't wearing a wetsuit, I'd be freezing my buns off. I'm still a little cold with the wetsuit on. And then things like breath holding practices, intermittent hypoxia, things like light therapy, UV light, red and near infrared light are hormetic stressors. There are certain kinds of chemicals that are hormetic stressors called xenobiotics. And there's also xenohormetic stressors, which are plant phytochemicals that stimulate a lot of these same hormetic stress pathways that can help build our mitochondria. So what we need in our lifestyle to maximize our mitochondrial health, and especially to prevent the loss of our cellular, the atrophy of our cellular engines, and to rebuild them healthy and strong, like youthful, big, strong, robust cellular engines, is we need adequate amounts and different types of these hormetic stressors built into our lifestyle.
And what are some of those hormetic stressors in terms of is there a nutrition component that plays into this as well? So I know we've just talked about the cold, the heat, the exercise, all those kinds of things, but how does nutrition play into this picture?
Yeah, arguably intermittent fasting or fasting variations are also a type of hormetic stress, as well as nutrient cycling. So to have periods of where you're removing certain nutrients, let's say carbs or low, you know, protein, to reduce that down for a period of a day or two or three, or to reduce total food intake, or to have a low calorie diet for a period of time. And then I mentioned the xenohormetic stressors as well, some of these plant phytochemicals that stimulate hormetic pathways. So there's a few different ways that nutrition ties into it.
And I know a lot of people, when they have challenges with fatigue and they wake up in the morning, they just don't have the energy, they can barely get out of bed, the first thing that they're going for is that cup of coffee. Why may that be the thing that they should be avoiding, or maybe seeking to go a little bit deeper beyond just covering it up with a cup of coffee?
Yeah. So this is a really interesting thing that's very counterintuitive for most people. So let me first explain how caffeine actually works to increase our energy levels, and then I'll explain the answer to your question. So we have a variety of different neurotransmitters in our brain. And some of these neurotransmitters are stimulatory and some of them are inhibitory. This means some of them are stimulating, create higher energy. Some of them create lower energy or more relaxing, sleepy time neurotransmitters. And the brain likes to maintain a certain balance of those, right? If I was here in this interview, and I was, you know, like I was on meth or something, like that would not be a pleasurable experience for you.
And if you're on the podcast, go to the YouTube to watch that reaction.
So, on the other hand, if I was too inhibitory, then I would be struggling to pay attention and get the words out, right? And that would also be altered my voice. That would also be not very engaging, right? So there's an optimal sort of zone of stimulation and inhibition that we're trying to be here, and that the brain wants to be. Now, one of those neurotransmitters is called adenosine, and adenosine is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. When we have lots of it, then that adenosine, that higher level of adenosine, then interacts with adenosine receptors in the brain. When it locks into that receptor, it stimulates a cascade of reactions that make you sleepy, tired, lower energy. Okay, inhibitory neurotransmitter, low energy. So the way that caffeine works is on adenosine receptors, except it. And so basically, when you have a ton of caffeine flooding the system, that those caffeine molecules basically lock into those adenosine receptors. Only the difference is they don't trigger that cascade that adenosine triggers. All they do is plug up the receptor. So they block adenosine from getting in. And by preventing an inhibitory neurotransmitter from interacting with its receptor, it creates a stimulating, energizing effect. So that's primarily how caffeine works at the level of the brain, to increase our alertness, our reaction times, our physical and mental performance, our energy levels, right? That's why people like coffee. It's because it does all those things. And it does do all those things. And there's a huge body of literature showing that caffeine consumption does increase energy levels, improve mood, improve reaction time, improve physical performance, improve mental performance, all these different metrics that it can improve. It's a true ergogenic performance enhancing substance. But all of that research exists in what's called caffeine naive people, meaning if you take people who don't normally consume caffeine and then you give them caffeine, you can see all of those benefits that happen that I just mentioned above people who were given a placebo. But if you take caffeine non-naive people, meaning people who consume caffeine on a daily basis, regularly for long periods of time, all of those effects disappear. Okay. They disappear, meaning they become unmeasurable. You don't see improvements in any of those parameters. Yet here's the tricky part that's confusing for a lot of people. Subjectively, as the person taking the caffeine, I feel a boost, right? I feel when I take my coffee, I go from a less alert state, less energetic state, to a more alert and energetic state. So I do feel a boost. So how could both of those things coexist? The answer has to do with something in the literature called withdrawal reversal. So it turns out, you know, people have heard the term withdrawal, with like drug withdrawal. So if you take somebody who's an alcoholic or a meth addict or a cocaine addict, and then, you know, they've been consuming lots of it for a long period of time, and then you take it away, you get withdrawal symptoms and maybe severe headaches and brain fog and depression and mood instability and insomnia and whatever else, fatigue and all kinds of nasty symptoms. So it turns out that people who are chronic caffeine consumers have drug withdrawal effects, side effects from consuming coffee every single day. So literally, if you are consuming coffee this morning and this afternoon, by the time you wake up tomorrow morning, the way you feel is actually a sign of your drug withdrawal from coffee. Okay. Assuming that you consume coffee regularly. And so when you then consume the caffeine in that moment, you notice it elevates you. It improves your mood. It improves your alertness. It improves your energy levels. But the distinction is all it's doing is taking you back up to what used to be your normal levels of energy. It's not giving you an actual boost above normal. What happened is that by consuming coffee on a regular basis, you lowered your baseline levels of energy and mood and alertness. And now you are dependent on the substance to boost yourself back up to normal. And the reason why this is the case is because, as I said at the beginning, the brain likes to maintain a certain balance of neurotransmitters, stimulatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters. When you put caffeine into the system frequently on a daily basis, especially multiple times daily, you overstimulate the brain. You disrupt the brain, the balance the brain is trying to maintain between stimulatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters. It senses that it's being overstimulated. And as I said earlier in this podcast, the body is an adaptive machine. So what does it do? It's trying to maintain balance. You're overstimulating it. It goes, oh, we're being overstimulated. Let's bring the system back into balance. And it does that by creating more adenosine receptors on the brain and increasing the amount of adenosine that's present. So the baseline level of adenosine signaling, the amount of adenosine molecules interacting with adenosine receptors, increases dramatically. So that when that caffeine is out of your system, you now have more tiredness, more sleepiness, lower levels of energy as your new baseline normal. And again, now you've become dependent on a substance just to get back to what used to be, what should be your normal level of energy.
Wow. What are the mechanisms by which our sleep and circadian rhythm relate to energy?
Many. Let's focus on one aspect of that. So melatonin is, first of all, many people think of melatonin as a sleep supplement. Melatonin is actually a hormone. It's a hormone produced inside of our bodies. There's a lot to that story. Many people think it's just produced in the brain. It's actually also produced in the gut. And it turns out, as a more recent discovery, it's also produced at the cellular level by mitochondria. And this hormone, melatonin, is vital for a whole host of reasons. It has neuroprotective and anti-cancer effects, and it also has mitochondrial protective effects. So it turns out melatonin is actually pretty much the most potent mitochondrial antioxidant ever discovered. And not only does it directly protect mitochondria from harm, it also interacts with the internal antioxidant defense system and detoxification system. So this is our internal set of compounds that protects the cell, protects the mitochondria from damaging compounds, from excessive oxidants, from toxic compounds, and it helps detoxify them. And what melatonin does and should be doing every night while you sleep is recharging that system of that internal antioxidant system and detoxification system composed of things like glutathione and catalase and superoxide dismutase. So every night while we sleep, we should be getting this, our cells and our mitochondria being bathed in melatonin, which directly protects the mitochondria and recharges the system, the internal mechanism that protects them from harm, for the next day's stressors that you will inevitably be exposed to, right? So what happens then if you are suppressing melatonin by massive amounts? And it turns out that just being under standard room lighting in a home environment suppresses melatonin by upwards of 70%. So we're supposed to be having this huge surge of melatonin in the couple hours before bed and during sleep, but we're suppressing that, we're squashing it by 70% in most cases because of the modern environment. It's not the modern environment, and especially the way we do lighting in the modern world is not congruent, not in harmony with our biological design. And again, we're also, you know, it's a neuroprotective anti-cancer hormone as well. What happens if you you know, are chronically suppressing a powerful anti-cancer hormone every night, year after year for decades, might that increase your cancer risk pretty substantially? Yeah, I think so. So anyway, this is one key element of how the circadian rhythm ties in with our cellular energy generators. There's many others. So we have the circadian rhythm also interacts with a number of neurotransmitters. It interacts with dopamine, with serotonin, with orexin, which is a wakefulness neurotransmitter, with adenosine, I mentioned before, and with GABA as well, which is an inhibitory, relaxing, sleepy time neurotransmitter. So if you have a strong circadian rhythm, it helps GABA surge at night to help you go into sleep mode, right? If you don't have a strong circadian rhythm, and this, I'm just pulling one random example, let's say you don't have a strong GABA surge, might be hard to turn off your brain, and you might have racing thoughts that make it hard for you to fall asleep or make you wake up multiple times during the night. And if you don't sleep well enough or long enough, of course, that's going to massively impact your energy. We also know circadian rhythm ties in with a bunch of hormones. There are many hormones that are directly dependent on the circadian rhythm and have what's called a diurnal curve. They go up at one part of the day, they go down at another. Thyroid hormone is an example. This is a key regulator of our overall metabolic function and cellular energy production. Low thyroid hormone or dysregulated thyroid hormone means lower cellular energy production. Testosterone is another big one. And this is actually, most people don't know this, but testosterone is the most abundant sex hormone, not only for men, but also for women, right? So people think that, oh, like men have testosterone, women have estrogen. Actually, women have plenty of testosterone as well. They have more testosterone than they do estrogen. It's just they, relative to men, they have much less testosterone, but they still have a lot. This is a widespread misconception that like testosterone is not important for women. It's very important. Testosterone is also very much tied into circadian rhythm and sleep. And there's a diurnal curve of it. It's high in the morning, it's lower in the evenings. We have other aspects of this as well that are influenced by the circadian rhythm. When it's poor, you get increases in insulin resistance. So you have chronically elevated insulin levels. When circadian rhythm is poor, you don't get the growth hormone surge that you should be getting at night while you sleep. And cortisol and melatonin are also directly tied into this. So we have this set of all these different hormones that either indirectly or directly impact on cellular energy production, and also mood and other aspects of how we feel that relate to energy. And they need to be in coordination with one another. There's a quote I recently stumbled across that I really like that applies to this. If you have a symphony without a conductor, you have noise. But if you have a symphony with a conductor, you have music. So the conductor in this case is our circadian rhythm. And we need the inputs into that circadian clock, that 24-hour biological clock built into our brain. We need it to be optimal in order to create hormonal music, for all of those hormones to be sequencing and operating in tandem with one another and surging and going down at the right times.
And any strategies that you could share maybe for how you like to approach optimizing circadian rhythm for energy?
Yeah, of course. So the most important one is bright light in the eyes within half an hour of waking. And if you live in a sunny place and you can get up around sunrise, look directly at the sun for a couple minutes, that's pretty much all you need. If you're getting up quite a bit after the sun rises, don't look directly at the sun, but maybe look in the direction, allow that bright light to get in your eyes for a few minutes at least. And if you are in an overcast place, you're going to need more like 10 minutes or more. And so that's number one. Number two is get as much bright light as possible throughout the day. So the way the circadian clock works to tell the difference between day and night is based on the wavelengths and the intensity of light. So imagine that you are a person who wakes up in your house and you turn on the lights in your room, and you get ready, and then you get in your car and you go to work. You spend all day in an office in an indoor environment. Then you go home and in the evening, and you spend the rest of the night in your home under the same lighting, looking at screens. there's very little differential between the light exposure that you got, the wavelengths, and especially the intensity during the daytime versus the night. What we want is as much outdoor bright light exposure as possible during the daytime. And the more we get of that, the less sensitive, the less susceptible we are to the melatonin suppressing effects of artificial light at night, meaning the less that we will get low melatonin or melatonin suppression as a result of exposure to screens and indoor lighting in the evenings. So we want to create as big a differential as we can. And then in the evenings, we want to dim the lighting in our home. We want to create either dimly lit incandescent or fire lit or candle lit environments in our home, so we can switch off the overhead lighting, get some simple desk lamps with incandescent bulbs and get used to that kind of lighting or candle lighting. And the spectrum of that is important because it's very low in the blues and the greens, and it's dominant in the orange and red and infrared part of the spectrum. And then we want to block out the blues using blue blocking glasses. If we're using any screens, using softwares like Efflux and Iris to minimize or eliminate blue light emission from our screen. And we want complete darkness in our room at night, either using blackout curtains, or if we can't completely black out our room, then use an eye mask. So that's a very brief version of maybe 5 or 6 tips.
Sure, that's fantastic. And are there other things that you're aware of that relate to our energy levels too? Body composition, gut health, how do those things tie in? If we could maybe touch on those briefly.
I don't know if I could do it briefly, but I can certainly do it.
You can do it. Do it how you want to do it.
So, okay, you said body composition and gut health?
Yeah, let's start with body composition. I think that'd be okay.
So body composition, In a couple of very direct ways. So without getting into all the sort of the etiology, all the causal mechanisms of how we accumulate body fat, once we accumulate body fat, the excess body fat itself becomes an endocrine organ. It becomes essentially a gland in the body that is producing substances that are signaling to the rest of the body. And one of the things that it's doing is producing something called adipokines, which are basically inflammatory cytokines. In other words, have simply the presence of excess body fat on your body. You know, people think it's like this inert, benign tissue, but it's actually producing stuff. It's producing chemicals that are affecting all the tissues in the rest of your body. And it's creating essentially low-grade chronic inflammation. And those adipokines, these inflammatory signaling molecules, are directly sensed by mitochondria as a danger signal. So, you know, we talked about at the beginning of this how mitochondria pick up on signals. Well, one of the signals that they pick up on that cue them to the presence of danger in the body, one of the biggest ones, is inflammatory cytokines. So anything that produces large amounts of inflammatory cytokines, and this could be a physical injury, it could be overtraining, overexercising, it could be toxic compounds that we're exposed to in the air or food or water, any number of things. It could be an immune response to an infection, which infections, viruses, respiratory viruses increase inflammatory cytokines. All of those create this increased level of inflammatory cytokines, which signals to mitochondria that the body is under attack. And the body really isn't good at differentiating between these different signals and going, oh, this signal is just from excess body fat, we'll let that one slide. No, chronic inflammation is chronic inflammation. So it responds to the presence of that high elevated level of inflammatory cytokines in a similar way to how it would respond to a physical injury or to an infection. And one of the key things that it's designed to do in that context is decrease energy levels. So if you And there's an adaptive reason, this is getting a bit deeper, but there's an adaptive intelligent reason for why our body's designed that way. If you're under attack from a respiratory pathogen or an infection, your body doesn't want you going out and doing tons of exercise and doing tons of work and running around and expending more energy. It wants to shut down your energy expenditure so it can shift resources to fight off the threat. The same with a physical injury. If you fall down the side of a cliff and injure a whole bunch of your body's tissues or get a deep gash or something like that, you get increased inflammatory cytokines, or you break a leg, you get this increased inflammation, and that's designed to get you to rest. So your body can shift resources towards healing rather than expending energy elsewhere. So the same is true with excess body fat. It's a signal, a danger signal at the mitochondrial level that shifts energy to a lower state. Gut health, there's many different mechanisms at play, but when we have factors in our lifestyle or in our environment that contribute to poor gut health, and this could mean a few different things. It could mean poor microbial diversity and, you know, non-optimal balance of microbes in the gut. And it can also mean poor integrity of the gut barrier, so intestinal permeability or leaky gut. So, and oftentimes these things go together, because having an imbalance of microbes in the gut directly contributes to intestinal permeability. And a lot of the factors that contribute to one or the other do both at the same time. So things like antibiotics, things like toxins, things like poor diet will contribute to imbalanced microbes and intestinal permeability, alcohol consumption, all these kinds of things. So when we're in that situation, we have a few things going on. Let's say you've got imbalanced microbes, you've got intestinal permeability. Well, now you've got food particles that should be fully digested before they enter your bloodstream, but now they're not. They're leaking into the bloodstream, not fully digested. And now you've got immune reactions to that, creating an inflammatory state. Okay. Immune reactions are essentially synonymous for the most part with increased inflammation. So that in itself is a danger signal to mitochondria. When your immune system has to chronically fight off these undigested food particles. In addition, we have microbes in the gut that gram-negative microbes, bacteria, that produce a substance called lipopolysaccharide or endotoxin. And when we have intestinal permeability, those bacteria, the toxin and the bacteria themselves, start to leak into the bloodstream. They should not be leaking into the bloodstream. They should be either staying in the gut or getting pooped out, but they shouldn't be leaking into your bloodstream. And we know that state of what's called endotoxemia has been linked with numerous diseases, heart disease, neurodegenerative diseases, cancers, and with chronic fatigue as well. And we know that lipopolysaccharide is directly sensed by mitochondria as a danger signal. So it's directly toxic to mitochondria. So the presence of leaky gut directly causes mitochondrial toxins to be getting leaked into your bloodstream constantly. That's constantly signaling to them, turn down the dial on energy production, shift resource towards cellular defense. That at the big picture level is lowering your energy levels. And then one other mechanism, there's a bunch of cool stuff going on here. We at the level of the gut, we have a gut brain axis. So we have like what's going on in the health of our gut influences the health of our brain and neurotransmitters in the brain and balance of neurotransmitters. And there's also a gut mitochondria axis. So what's going on in our gut influences our mitochondria in a variety of ways. If we have adequate levels of butyrate producing bifidobacteria, these producers of short chain fatty acids, this substance called butyrate is not only critical for intestinal health and the health of the actual colonocytes, the colon cells, but is also used to help facilitate energy production at the mitochondrial level. So we need adequate amounts of this for our mitochondria to be working optimally. So when we don't have that, that's one aspect of the gut mitochondria axis. Another aspect is certain microbes in the gut metabolize compounds in the diet and turn them into other compounds that are active at the mitochondrial level. So one example is with phytochemicals in particular, there's a compound called ellagic acid, which is found in a number of different berries in particular in small amounts, but it's found most abundantly in pomegranates and chestnuts. And this ellagic acid gets metabolized by certain gut microbes into another compound called urolithin A. And urolithin A is pretty much the most powerful promoter of mitophagy that's ever been discovered. So mitophagy is, if people have heard of autophagy, this is autophagy at the mitochondrial level. This is basically breaking down and getting rid of dysfunctional mitochondria and cleaning them up. It's like a quality control process at the mitochondrial level to maintain a healthy pool of mitochondria. And we need that to be happening in adequate amounts on a daily basis. So basically, if your gut health isn't stellar, if you've got gut permeability, if you've got an imbalance of microbes, well, now you've got these toxins leaking into your bloodstream, poisoning your mitochondria all the time. And you've got, maybe you don't even have the presence of the microbes to metabolize these compounds from the diet into things like urolithins, things like butyrate that are affecting the ability of the mitochondria to produce energy or to clean themselves up and get rid of the low quality damaged mitochondria. So there's a variety of mechanisms that it impacts.
And you mentioned a really powerful compound there, urolithin A. What are, and that obviously came from our diet, from our nutrition. That's when people think of what are the things I can actually do to affect, you know, or improve my mitochondrial function. I bet a lot of people are thinking about nutrition. What are some other things nutritionally maybe that are going to also impact our energy?
Anything that helps you from a nutritional perspective, anything that helps you maintain optimal body composition and reduce excess body fat will help remove that as a chronic low-grade source of inflammation. Anything that helps you maintain optimal balance of blood sugar is critically important. So when we have low blood sugar, obviously, you know, hypoglycemia creates fatigue if you can't provide the fuel to mitochondria, but hyperglycemia also is toxic to mitochondria. Having elevated blood sugar levels, which is also largely the result of having excess body fat, is itself directly toxic to mitochondria. So the presence of very high levels of sugar in the bloodstream is basically damaging to mitochondria, and the cells create insulin resistance as an adaptive defense mechanism to prevent too much of that from getting inside of the cell. So there's many different aspects of reducing blood sugar levels through your diet. I don't want to go too overtime in that discussion, but reducing excess body fat and then using tools to optimize your blood sugar based on what you're eating and adding things like cinnamon, vinegar, altering the order in which you're eating foods to include more greens and more fiber in the meal, more protein in the meal, consuming them first in the meal. All of those things can have a profound impact on maintaining healthy levels of blood sugar and making it so your mitochondria aren't sensing this huge surge of toxicity every time you eat. Using nutrition to optimize gut health, you know, of course, we can use different compounds in the diet to help heal our what's going on in our gut. So amino acids are critical to that. Immunoglobulins from things like colostrum are critical for healing the gut. Many different dietary compounds, things like zinc and zinc carnosine in particular, are necessary and very helpful for healing the gut. And, you know, we can do lots of things with herbs as well. Deglycerinated licorice, for example. And then what we also can do with our diet is, of course, feed the microbes in our intestines. So we need to eat an optimal diet rich in a diversity of prebiotic fibers in order to have an optimal balance of bacteria in the gut, that where we have adequate amounts of those types of bacteria that are producing the short chain fatty acids, that butyrate, to allow mitochondria to keep humming along, that are producing so we have optimal amounts of those bacteria that will digest certain phytochemicals and then metabolize them into other compounds that then create these anti-inflammatory, antioxidant, immune boosting, mitochondrial protective effects, right? So there are many different aspects of how that works.
That's amazing. And last thing, I know we're pretty much at our time here, but I want to just touch on one last thing here, which would be, you know, supplementation, right? Super important for people when it comes to, obviously we're trying to get everything from diet and nutrition first, but sometimes you've got to supplement in certain areas. Are there any supplements that you have for mitochondrial health, for energy enhancement, that you highly recommend that are research supported?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my whole book has a chapter, like an encyclopedia, on supplements for energy support and mitochondrial support. In my new book, Eat for Energy, I think that chapter alone is worth the cost of the whole book. There's so much great information, but there's many, many compounds. I would also say, you know, that there's been this idea around for a long time that's like, oh, you shouldn't need supplements, like you should get everything from your diet. And, you know, that's the best way to do it. I agree, you should have an optimal, very healthy diet, but there's lots of supplements that you can't get in a diet. Like there's no, you don't get rhodiola rosea in your diet. Right? Like there's many different specific compounds that it doesn't matter how healthy your diet is, you're not getting that compound. Unless you supplement with spirulina, there is no spirulina in your diet. And the compounds that are in spirulina are not arriving in you from consuming kale or broccoli or steak or whatever. So, you know, to get specific benefits of specific compounds, you've got to use those compounds, and you can't get them unless you supplement with them. And so at one time I was a purist and I said, oh, you know, you shouldn't need supplements. You got to get it all from the diet. But if there's research supporting this particular compound as having this, this, and this benefit, what is the argument against using it? You know, like, and I've never heard somebody give a compelling answer to that question. Like, why should I not use spirulina? If spirulina has all these proven benefits, no risk of harm, tell me the reasons, the argument that you think I should not use spirulina. It's like, oh, because it's a supplement and you shouldn't use supplements. I'm like, okay, well, if you want to be a slave to that mental framework, feel free. I'm going to carry on using my spirulina, you know, like, so anyway, rhodiola rosea is a great example of a compound with lots of proven benefits, specifically for people with chronic fatigue and stress-related exhaustion, showing benefits of in as little as 7 days in many cases, showing 30, 40, 50% reductions in scores of fatigue and perceived stress and irritability in many different parameters and mood parameters as well. Depression is another aspect that commonly overlaps with fatigue. There are great compounds for this too. Rhodiola rosea has great research. Lion's mane has great research showing 20, 30, 40% reductions in depression and anxiety in the span of 4 or 8 or 12 weeks, depending on the study. Another great compound that I'll mention here is astaxanthin. And this is a carotenoid that's found in certain species of algae, and it also accumulates up the food chain. So this is the reason why flamingos and why salmon have their pink color. It's ultimately from consuming the foods that are rich in astaxanthin. The krill eat the algae, and then other creatures eat the krill, and then it goes up and up the food chain. And this carotenoid also accumulates in our tissues, where it literally embeds itself in the mitochondrial membranes and stabilizes and protects the mitochondria from damage. And salmon have so much of this, it literally turns their flesh pink, right? So that's the potential of, you know, how much this can be embedded into our tissues in a very lasting way. And it's not just that it's coloring the tissues. It's not just a dye. It's actually providing these physiological benefits to protect mitochondrial membranes from damage. And there's a variety of other benefits, some more meaningful depending on which context you're in, but it acts as an internal sunscreen and protects the skin from UV damage. And at the mitochondrial level, stabilizes and protects the membranes from oxidative damage, and has been shown to increase energy production at the cellular level and increase athletic performance, measures of endurance and stamina and things like that. And then maybe one other one that I'll mention here is NT factor phospholipid supplements. So NT factor is a patented phospholipid formulation. I'm shocked at how few people know about this supplement, because it's got amazing research to support it. There's a paper by a researcher named Garth Nicholson. The paper's called Lipid Replacement Therapy. And it compiles all this research that's been done on this phospholipid extract from maybe close to a dozen studies that have been done in people, different groups with chronic fatigue of different types. So chronic fatigue syndrome, aging associated chronic fatigue in older people, obesity related chronic fatigue, and then things, you're a military guy, so you'd appreciate this, in Gulf War illness, for example, that it's been studied, you know, people who were poisoned in the Gulf War. And in across the board in all of these studies, you see 25 to 45% increases in energy levels in the span of, depending on the study, 4 to 8 weeks, just from doing this one compound. So yeah, that's it. Those are a few of my favorite compounds.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. I mean, Ari, this has been an amazing episode. Definitely one of my favorites that I've done so far. And it's been a pleasure chatting with you. And for everybody listening, if you thought this was interesting or you learned something new, let me know in the comments below what you learned, like it, share it with somebody else that you know could benefit from it, that maybe doesn't have the energy, and you know it's maybe it's your spouse or your partner, a significant other, somebody else, share this with them. And then I want to make sure we let everyone know, Ari, where can people find you and your work?
Yeah, the best place is theenergyblueprint.com.
Perfect. So we'll make sure we link that in the show notes. And you can find all of the resources, show notes, everything mentioned here today in this episode over at bonecoach.com/Ari Witten, The Energy Blueprint. I want to thank everyone again so much for their time. We'll see you in the next episode. Hope you found this episode of The Bone Coach Show helpful. You can find all the resources, show notes, everything mentioned over at bonecoach.com. If you enjoyed this episode and found it helpful, be sure to share it with someone you love, a friend, family member, even a group of people. And also be sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode that can help you improve your bones, your health, and your future. One last reminder, if you haven't done so already, head over to bonecoach.com for more great resources to help you get on the path to stronger bones and an active future. I'm your Bone Coach, Kevin Ellis. I'll see you in the next episode.